Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome to all of you at home or wherever you are. So we're continuing our study of the Lotus Sutra, and we're going to concentrate on chapter 7 and 8. While I'm thinking about it, the next time we meet, we'll do 9 through 11 and concentrate mostly on 10 and 11 in terms of what we'll be doing here. And so in these chapters tonight, we have a couple of parables. One of them, well, both of them kind of well, pretty well known. And if you're reading the Lotus Sutra for the first time, you really see how unusual it is in Mahayana Sutras for these parables. You know, the Buddha used lots and lots of similes and metaphors in his teaching. I'm trying to think of some of the stories he told that were they, you know, doesn't matter, were they strictly parables or not, but he used a lot of teaching devices like that. So we begin, this is the chapter on the Phantom City, and we begin with this fairly lengthy telling about this Buddha, great universal wisdom excellence, who the Buddha is saying that many, long time ago, longer than you can conceive of, there was this Buddha, great universal wisdom excellence, and that since that time, a huge amount of time has passed. And then right away, he says that when this Buddha was practicing, that he passed 10 small kalpas before the doctrines or the teachings of the Buddhas finally appeared before him. And he was able to... he talks about how this Buddha, who lived for a very, very long time, at first sat in the place of practice and having smashed the armies of the devil, or Mara, was on the point of attaining Anuttara Samyak Sambuddhi, which is becoming a completely enlightened Buddha. But the teachings or the doctrines of the Buddhas didn't appear before him. And this state continued for one small kalpa and so on for 10 small kalpas. The Buddha sitting with legs crossed, body and mind unmoving, but the teachings of the Buddha still did not appear before him. And some of you will recognize that as a koan that appears in the Gateless Gate. This is the Buddha, this is where a master, Qingzhang, brought this up. And he said, this Buddha, great universal wisdom excellence, did sit zazen on a bodhisattva for 10 kalpas. Buddha Dharma was not manifested. The teachings did not appear before him, nor did he attain Buddhahood. Why? A student asked Master Qingzhang this question. And Qingzhang said, your question is splendid indeed. And the student persisted and said, this Buddha practiced zazen on a bodhisattva. Why did he not attain Buddhahood? And Qingzhang said, because he did not attain Buddhahood. And so here, and this happens in a number of occasions, Wu Man has taken this, or Qingzhang has taken just this part of the sutra. Because if you turn the page, it seems to resolve. Right? But he's taking it, he's sort of taking it as a complete event where Qingzhang sat all of this time and never attained Buddhahood. And why? Because Qingzhang said he did not attain Buddhahood. And so, ponder that. But as he continued, eventually he did attain Anuttara Samyak Sambuddhi. And then it says, 500, 10,000 million Buddha worlds in each of the 10 directions trembled and shook in 6 different ways. And so if you're not familiar with the sort of Buddhist cosmology of the universe, then check it out. It's a big one. And there are lots of worlds. We just happen to occupy one of them, Jambudvipa. And in all of these worlds, there are different world systems and different beings, and different Buddhas. And as often is the case, and this is really goes back to original teachings, is that when something very significant happens, particularly within the realm of enlightenment, that the world shakes, right? That there is a kind of response from the earth. And so the world, all of these Buddha worlds trembled in six different ways. The dark and secluded places within those lands, where the light of the sun and moon is never able to penetrate, were all brightly illuminated. And the living beings were all able to see one another. So for the first time, they could see one another. And they exclaimed, saying, "How is it that living beings have suddenly come into existence in this place?" So it's interesting to think about that as a grand way of speaking about a very large universe, and also what happens when our world is suddenly illuminated. You know, what is enlightenment? We tend to think of it as when something that is moving along in a negative way now moves along in a positive way, or something that is by its nature negative now has become positive. Some change has taken place. And so this goes back to, why did this great being sit for all these kalpas and not attain Buddhahood? Chung Ching says, because he didn't attain Buddhahood. And here it says that suddenly all these beings can see each other for the first time. Okay, so I want to just go on and speak and cover a few pages, and then we'll stop and see where the questions are. So then these Brahma kings whose worlds are trembling and shaking are wanting to know what's going on. And their palaces are shaking, and so they all gather together. Do you know what's going on? No, I don't. Do you know what's going on? And so at that time, they take their palaces, which is a wonderful image. They take their palaces with them, and they go to the place where great universal wisdom excellence is, on his place of practice, seated on a lion's throne, with heavenly beings and all kinds of beings. And they make their reverence, and then they want to know what's happening. And so then they ask for the teaching. "We beg the world honored one to turn the wheel of the law, save living beings, and open up the way to nirvana." And then a whole host of monastics in the southeast act in a similar way. Their world is shaking, so they come en masse, make their bows to the Buddha, and ask for the teaching. And then a whole group of people, beings from the northwest region, come. And then the southern region, and the northern region, and the lower region. They all come. They're all there. Everybody's there. And they all pay their respects, and then they ask for the teaching. And so finally, the great universal wisdom excellence, thus come one, Buddha, receiving entreaties from the Brahma kings of the 10 directions and from the 16 princes. So this Buddha had 16 children, right? Who, as soon as this Buddha attained enlightenment, the great enlightenment, they all went to study with this Buddha who was their father. And so all of these beings have assembled and have asked for the teaching. And so it says, this Buddha then immediately gave three turnings to the 12-spoked wheel of the law. No one else was capable of such a teaching. And the Buddha said, "Here is suffering. Here is the origin of suffering. Here is the cessation of suffering. And here is the path to the cessation of suffering. The Four Noble Truths." And then the Buddha broadly expounded the law of the 12-linked chain of causation. And in the Watson translation, he uses the word cause. Delusion or ignorance causes action. Action causes consciousness. Consciousness causes name and form. And this is a little problematic because it creates a sense of a determinative relationship, that something causes something else to happen. This sounds very deterministic. And so think of it more in terms of condition. That's often how it's translated into English, that delusion conditions our consciousness. So if you think about how delusion influences, has an influencing effect, a conditioning effect on our consciousness. And then consciousness being conditioned by our delusion, false views, attachments, attachment to self, thinking things are permanent, and so on, conditions name and form, which is basically you, your body, your name, your psychophysical being, as it's sometimes referred to. In the teaching of the chain of causation, in terms of how this is a description of rebirth, this is the point at which consciousness comes into the womb and conception takes place. And now having a body and mind, we have sense organs, and so the delusion which has conditioned our consciousness, sometimes refers to as mental formations, karmic formations, the kleshas, conditions our body and mind, conditions our senses. And remember that senses here includes sense consciousness. So it's not just that it's conditioning the eye and the ear and our skin and our tongue, but rather that it's conditioning our consciousness within each of those senses, such that when we make contact, as we continue this chain of causation, the way we have experienced contact with our world through those senses is conditioned, beginning with delusion, karmic formations, and now into contact with sensory objects. And this then conditions our sensation. What do we actually experience? And that then conditions what kinds of desires arise, right? Based on how our consciousness has been formed, it influences what we actually experience in terms of pain or pleasure, and how those desires arise. And then our desires then condition our attachments. Do we want more? How much do we want? How strong is it? Is it attraction? Is it revulsion? And that then conditions our existence. And this is where coming into being, right? This is another rebirth, coming into being, which then conditions our actual next life, our actual birth. If you think of this in terms of a moment-to-moment chain of causation, then it's a conditioning that is happening moment after moment. And that then conditions our life, our aging, our sickness, our death, our worry and grief, our suffering and anguish, as the Buddha would describe it, our mass of suffering. And then, but if we enlighten that delusion, then that whole sort of basis is liberated from its delusion. So then that liberates our karmic formations, which liberates our in our consciousness, which liberates name and form, which liberates the six sense organs and how we contact and come into sensation. And so on, this is how the whole cycle is either a cycle of suffering, of recreating samsara over and over again, or how it transforms into liberation. And so this is these are two of the most significant original teachings of the Buddha. And I've read scholars who've proposed that dependent origination is such a complex view, a complex understanding that that proposed that it wasn't actually in the Buddha's original teaching, but it was something that developed over time. It doesn't really matter, although in the Buddha's own account of his enlightenment, he saw this. But these are two of the really essential teachings that all of Buddhism, in a sense, are based in and merit study. Right? Okay, so the Buddha offers this teaching. Now, also, it's worth mentioning within the context of the sutra that this is an original teaching. So although these teachings are very much present in the Mahayana tradition, they're considered original teachings. So it's not that they're, I don't know if it would be true to say that they're more associated with the early school, because they're so important within the Mahayana as well, but they're definitely not uniquely Mahayana teachings. Right? So they're shared, but they might be more associated with original teachings. And that will become clear as to why that's true as we continue. So at this point, everybody wants more. And so the 16 children of the Buddha come and want, and the Buddha starts talking about how they come and they want more teachings. And so the Buddha then preaches the Lotus of the Wonderful Law, the Lotus Sutra. Right? So this is now going back. Remember, this is this earlier Buddha that the Buddha in this sutra is referring back to. So he's telling everybody in the assembly about, like, millions and millions of years ago, there was this Buddha who sat on the Bodhi seat, the teachings did not appear, finally they did, and then all of this is happening. And so with all of the pleas for a teaching, then that Buddha long, long time ago taught the Lotus Sutra. So that's an interesting twist. Right? So here's a sutra that the Buddha is saying has never been taught. And then he's talking about how this has been taught, actually, before. And so this Buddha, hard to remember his name, he's got such a long name, taught, and everyone in assembly gained faith and accepted it, and all the voice hearers, the Shravakas, all of these original disciples of the Buddha, who remember, thought that they had attained the complete path and had realized all there was to realize and attained full enlightenment. The Buddha, at the very beginning of the sutra, says, no, that's not true. 5,000 leave, these remain. They are now, their minds are opened, they have faith in it, and they are well on their way. And then it said that Buddha preached this sutra for a period of 8,000 kalpas, never once stopping to rest. And after having preached this sutra, he entered a quiet room. Oh, yeah. And dwelled in meditation for a period of 84,000 kalpas. Long time. And so in his absence, all of these 16 children who are now well on their way on the Buddhist path, of the one vehicle, take over and basically step in and begin teaching on the distinctions put forth in the Lotus Sutra. Okay, and then it goes on. And eventually it comes to this parable. So we'll shift to that, but first I want to see if there are any comments or questions or thoughts on what we've covered.
This is just something that comes, I think, out of our liturgy when we talk about the 16 guardians. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if these were the same 16.
I don't think so. Okay. Somebody asked me recently, and I forgot to actually go look that up. I've looked it up before. I think it has to do with the cardinal points, right? The guardians of each cardinal point, and then the basically north, northeast, east, so on around, and then zenith and nadir. I think it refers to guardians of each of those sort of cardinal positions.
I'm curious, it's like so many that tied in. Oftentimes there's a being or something associated with a direction in...
A being?
A being. So I'm just... I don't
associated
know.
With...
A direction.
Oh, direction, yes.
Yeah. Yes. And so, yeah.
Yeah, well, if you have a guardian, you want a being, right? You want a guardian that can actually guard.
Yeah.
Protect.
Yeah.
Like you. You would qualify. You'll let me know if anybody from... Okay.
Can you tell them to chat? Some
of them have... Everybody at home, if you want to ask a question, just put it in the chat, okay? And Yusen will harvest them. You know, so one of the things that is obviously... you know, a question or is sort of a reflection is what do you do as you take all of this in? You know, what is that doing to your mind? Why, what is the function of this? Because this is a sutra, it's a teaching, right? It's trying to convey something. It's trying to communicate about the Dharma. And we've talked about this early on about how it can be, you know, sutras can be establishing certain teachings. They can be establishing, in this sense, in this context, the Mahayana tradition, happening as it did fairly early on, and having been amended or added to over several hundred years, which scholars sort of interpret to mean that it was considered an important sutra during its time because it was kept alive and kept sort of evolving. And so to think about, and of course we live in our time, right? We don't live a millennia or more ago. And so our way of understanding the world and understanding, you know, what we can touch and what we can't touch, what we can know and what we can't know may be different. But because this is the time we're in, you know, how does taking this in, what does it do? You know, just in terms of the time explosion, the timelessness of this, in terms of the magnitude, in terms of all of these many beings, you know, that are sort of coming from all of these different worlds, all of these different Buddhas. So really, you know, reflecting on this not as you know, history in terms of historical events, but the history of a teaching that has come down to us. You know, in this way.
I mean, I guess what I was thinking when I was, especially when I was hearing you talk about, I mean, just like, it seems like, I mean, it's like just talking to a couple of things, like the cyclical nature of, and also that, like, it's a self-evident teaching, like that, like, it's just reality.
Self-evident in the sense of...
In that it's truth. Mm-hmm. Like that it's not generated by mm-hmm. the Buddha. It's just mm-hmm. the way it is. Mm-hmm. Like in that, just like the Four Noble Truths and the 12-fold mm-hmm. chain,
right.
Then the next
right.
like sequence would be the Lotus Sutra, which always exists, always will exist. It kind of feels like it's in the context of, you know, I mean, I guess you could also see it as like justifying the teaching and yeah. that it's always there. And so even if it is the first time, it's kind of always, that makes more sense in that way.
Yeah. And when we think about how we, you know, our lives become so singular and in a sense so isolated, you know, it's my life. And then when we start to think about that in a larger way, you know, in the Bodhisattva path in terms of service, what our lives are about, in terms of, you know, really realizing our self nature, that we're not fundamentally separate from each other, that our basic nature is one nature that takes all of these multitudes of forms, and how that sort of loosens up that confinement that we have. When we think about practice as a path, and so in those moments when we think, oh, I've blown it, you know, I'm ruined, you know, I failed, we have this very absolute way of looking at things. And really looking at it in terms of the path opens that up, because we realize this is just one moment in a much, much larger path, even if we're just talking about our lives. If we think about it from the point of view of rebirth, then it becomes even larger. Right? Where we have, there's every reason to live this life in the best way possible, right? In every way possible to be a benefit to ourselves and others. And it's also just one life. Remember when Pema Khandro gave a retreat last year, I think, and she said, you know, if you're sick or you're worried about dying, don't worry, because you've died hundreds and thousands of times before. And if you're dying a difficult death, you've died so many worse deaths before. You know, you can't even imagine. And it's like, you know, if you really believe in that, to think about, you know, how that might loosen things up. But even just to contemplate, you know, this life in a much larger context. And then, why stop there? And so then to just expand on that world, on this universe, on the universes that exist, in which this has been going on over and over. So we make much about Shakyamuni Buddha, right? Because he's the Buddha of our time. But what in this Lit Sutra, the Buddha himself is saying is, you know, he's just one of many. And then when you turn that around and move forward into all of these prophecies, you know, it's like thinking about this. So the Bodhisattva path is often called a path of universal compassion, right? A universal view, a sort of an unlimited view.
A couple questions I think you might have answered. The first one, why is the vastness of time emphasized so repeatedly? How do we relate this cosmic vastness to modern Western understandings of time? I think you touched on that.
You know, one thought that just comes to me is that if you think about that period of time, how long did people live? You know? And so the even perhaps more fleeting nature of time and life, and then you think about these lifespans that went on for kalpas.
Here's a slightly different question. When the brilliant light appears in all the palaces, such as had never been seen before, and the Brahma kings wonder where this light has come from, it is because some the birth of some heavenly being of great virtue, and likely it's because the Buddha has appeared in the world to save living beings in their suffering. And Anson says, sounds like a familiar story to me. What would you say about those similarities?
With what?
I think she's referring to like the birth of Christ.
Oh.
The heavenly being, bright light.
Well, the Buddha is certainly said to have had a somewhat special birth, right? Came out walking and talking. And so often, you know, sages, you know, deeply enlightened beings are given, credited with special births. But you know, I think of that illumination in terms of the illumination of enlightenment, that image of being in darkness, right? You know, so if we think of delusion as being in a world where we don't know that we're in darkness, or we don't know that we're asleep, we just know what we know. And we're moving about in that world because that's the only world there is. And things work, you know, so-so. We bump into people, we get into arguments, we work it out sometimes not. And then there's a great illumination. It's the same world. Nothing has changed. The same people are there. And you realize now for the first time you can see these people that have been in the room with you all along. Right? And before, just to extend it, we were seeing something, right? So we thought we were seeing something. We were seeing something. But now we realize we weren't seeing them as they are. We weren't seeing them completely. We weren't seeing them fully because now our eyes are opened or there's an illumination. And so that sense of light that's used in so many religious traditions here is not so much a physical light, you know, that we shouldn't in our practice go looking for light, but rather the light of illumination. Okay. So why don't we go into the parable? Just to step back a bit, in before he gets into the parable, it says, the Buddha is saying, this is the bottom of 134 of the Watson text. It says, monks, when I and these other shramaneras, these other practitioners, each one of us taught and converted living beings equal in number to immeasurable hundreds, thousands of Ganges sands, they heard the law from us and attained Anuttana Samyak Sambuddhi. Some of these living beings are now dwelling in the ranks of voice hearers. They're here now in this assembly. But we have constantly instructed them in Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, and these persons should be able, through this law, through this Dharma, to enter into the Buddha way, albeit gradually. They should be able to do that, although it will be a gradual process. Why do I say this? Because the wisdom of the Thus Come One is difficult to believe and difficult to understand. Difficult to have faith in and difficult to understand or experience directly. Okay. You know, what I was also thinking before we go on is that in all of this precursor to the teaching that happened with the Four Noble Truths and the chain of causation, this just, you know, huge universe of worlds. And then finally the teaching comes and it's the first teaching. It's the first teaching the Buddha gave. And so that, remember, in this whole sort of the theme, one of the themes of the sutra is that there's one vehicle, not many. And yet, because the Dharma is difficult to understand, difficult to have faith in, we need to practice into it gradually. Right? And from the Mahayana perspective, and this is a Mahayana teaching, that the Mahayana sutras are more advanced sutras. And so the Buddha originally tried to teach them, nobody understood, and so then he began with what we now consider the original teachings, Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, karma, and so on. And in order to, for us to be prepare ourselves, in a sense, to be able to engage in the more complete teaching. So it's both looking at it in terms of a kind of an evolution of Buddhism perspective, in terms of the development of Mahayana, but really, and that's true in terms of history, but, you know, relevant to us as practitioners, it's also really talking about what happens, you know, in time. As we begin, what do we begin with? What are the teachings we begin with? What are the practices we begin with? And it's these practices. Okay, so in the parable, the Buddha says, he says, you must understand this. The Thus Come One, in his use of expedient means, penetrates deeply into the nature of living beings. He knows how their minds delight in petty doctrines, and how deeply they are attached to the five desires. And because they are like this, when he expounds nirvana, teaches on nirvana, He does so in such a way that these persons hearing it can readily believe, have faith in it, and accept it. Okay, so recognize also this ongoing emphasis on skillful means, how essential that is. That it needs to be, what is taught needs to be true. So even though it may be considered, you know, a lesser vehicle or a lesser teaching, it's a true teaching. It's lesser only in the sense that it's not a complete teaching, that there's more. And so for it to be skillful means it has to be true. It has to be true Dharma. And it has to be accepted by the student as be able to, we have to be able to hear it and have some measure of faith in it and understand it enough to be able to put it into practice. If those things aren't there, then if for us, that's not a skillful means. We hear it, but nothing happens, right? It doesn't actually stay with us. It doesn't go in. And so think about how teachers repeat themselves over and over and over again, right? And it literally happens that a student will come and say about such a teaching, why haven't you ever taught this before? So the Buddha says, let us suppose there's a stretch of bad road, 500 yojanas long, steep and difficult, wild and deserted, with no inhabitants around, a truly fearful place. There's a number of people who really want to pass over this road. They want to get to this place where there's a city of rare treasures. They really want to get there. They have a leader, somebody of comprehensive wisdom and keen understanding, a guide. Somebody who has been on that path before, knows the obstacles, knows the twists and turns, knows how long it is, who is thoroughly acquainted with this steep road, knows its passes and defiles, and is prepared to guide them. The group they are leading, after going part of the way, become disheartened. They're tired, they're discouraged. It's not going as they planned. It's much longer than they thought. It's more difficult than they thought, even though they were warned. All of these things were told to them. Right? But when I heard them, I heard them in my world. So when I heard long according to my mind. I heard difficult according to my, and I thought, I can do that. Because it was long and difficult according to me. Right? But now I'm encountering long and difficult according to the Dharma. Or in, you could say, according to that part of myself that I had not yet met. And so discouraged and disheartened, they say, we are utterly exhausted and fearful as well. We can't go any further. There's such a long distance ahead. It would just be better to turn around and go back. And the leader, a person of many experiences, thinks to themselves, what a pity, what a shame. They've come this far. They're well on the way. They are on the right path. They have what is necessary, but they don't have the energy, the spirit, the trust. And if they turn back, then they are abandoning those rare treasures that they are seeking, right? And they won't see them. They won't find them. And what they will have is just the idea of this was a difficult path that could not be accomplished. That will be the completion of the path for them. And so having had this thought, the leader resorts to the power of expedient means. And so they go a little bit further up, and then the leader says, don't be afraid. Don't turn back. Look. There's a city right there. And it's wonderful. You can stop. You can rest. You can take a nap. There's plenty of food. You can do as you please. You'll be at ease and be tranquil. And then later, we'll talk about it. If you feel you can go to the place where the treasure is, then you can leave the city. And so they're overjoyed, they're exhausted, but their minds are refreshed. They think this is such an unprecedented event. We weren't expecting this. We've escaped that dreadful road, and now we have ease and tranquility. Why don't we just stay here? This is such a better place than we were. Why don't we just stay here? That seems like an excellent idea. I never expected to get to this. But at that time, the leader, knowing that the people are rested and that they're no longer fearful or weary, dissolves the phantom city. It's gone. You cannot stay here. You must go now. The place where the treasure is close by. That great city of a while ago was a mere phantom that I conjured up so you could rest. And so then he says, the Buddha is in a similar position. Acting as a leader, knows the bad road of birth and death. Earthly desires are steep, difficult, long, and far-stretching, but it must be traveled, it must be passed over. If the living beings hear of only the one Buddha vehicle, then they will not want to see the Buddha, will not want to draw near him, but will immediately think to themselves, this is too long, far-stretching, it's too laborious, too difficult. What here is he referring to in terms of the one Buddha vehicle? Not quite. That's part of it. But what vehicle is he talking about here? He says, if the living beings hear only of the one vehicle, then...
The Theravada school, no?
No. The what?
Like the full thing.
The full thing. Because remember, there is only one vehicle. So if we only hear of the one vehicle, right? In other words, if we're presented with the whole path, then we will think, oh, this is too much, right? I thought that. When Dada Roshi would talk about saving all sentient beings, alleviating suffering of all beings, I thought, that is way too far out of range. Right? So even though he was teaching that, I was not aspiring to that. Not originally. Right? I was more in the let's wait and see strategy of mind. But I believe that's what he's pointing to. But they'll think to themselves, this is too long, too far stretching. So the Buddha knows that the minds of living beings are timid and weak and lowly. And that here doesn't mean inferior, but it means attached to things that are easy to grab onto. And so using the power of expedient means, the Buddha preaches two nirvanas, two liberations. First, liberate yourself. Study and practice the Four Noble Truths. Liberate your mind, practice non-attachment, right? Free yourself of suffering. In order to provide a resting place along the road. And so then as we see the fruits of that practice develop, and our lives are changing, right? And again, you know, this is presenting this in a very sort of neat and cut and dried fashion. You know, that this is a very distinct path over here, and this is a very distinct path over here. And of course, in our training, it's not like that, right? Because the whole path is presented at once. And yet, in people's actual practice, they are, in a sense, practicing both, but in terms of their what we do in our meditation and what we do with our mind, it is more sort of working towards self-liberation. And then to think about what happens so that as that's happening and you're gaining confidence and you're gaining faith in the teachings and the practice because you're seeing it and you're seeing changes, there's that sense of, you know, your capacity that is changing, right? The sense that what you might have thought you couldn't do before, you can do now. So in the beginning, coming to a weekend session might have felt like pushing you right to the limit, right? I mean, just think about it in that way. And then you do that and you realize, okay, I did that, I can do that. And so I'll do a little bit more. And your capacity changes, or rather our sense of our capacity, right, changes. And we are gaining faith. And as we gain faith, we trust more and we engage more. We can hear more, right? Because it's not just a muscular thing, right? I mean, that's the least part of it, really. It's our mind is changing, our faith is changing, our ability to hear and understand is changing. And so then we're able to open it up a little bit more. Okay, so let's pause there. Is there a mic on the side of the room?
This might just be semantics, but where does the eightfold path, like, is that what he's referring to as the one vehicle, or is that like a, he didn't, those terms aren't used, but that was kind of coming to mind for me.
I would include that with the, you know, Four Noble Truths and condition arising, that's an original teaching. And it's also very much, I mean, all of their, essentially, the original teachings are all part of the Mahayana tradition, right? The way they're taught sometimes, the emphasis, and so on, sometimes a little bit different. But so that's, it's sort of implicit.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think. Because, I mean, that's the fourth of the Four Noble Truths, right? The path.
Can you clarify a little more the one vehicle? You mentioned the four bodhisattva, the bodhisattva vow, the bodhisattva path.
So the one vehicle that's being referred to here is the bodhisattva path. It is the path of what we express in the four vows. It is what's expressed in raising bodhicitta, liberating self and other, enlightening self and other, alleviating the suffering of self and other. That is the one vehicle that is being taught here and referred to as the one vehicle. The you know, we touched on this in the beginning, that the it's not three vehicles. So the path of the Shravakas, the voice hearers, of the Pratyeka Buddhas, the solitary Buddhas, those who just come to enlightenment on their own, or the Bodhisattva path, that it's not three separate vehicles, it's just one. And that what he's making clear basically is that everybody who is in this assembly, and he's speaking, right, mostly to the disciples, the early disciples, and he's saying, he's letting them know, you're actually on the Bodhisattva path. You didn't know it. You didn't know it because I didn't tell you. And on the next page after the parable, it says, the Buddha knew that the time had not yet come. And though they had asked, he sat in silence. He's kind of referring to another thing, but that that in his teaching of the original teachings, he knew in his mind, I mean, this is the perspective from the Lotus Sutra, that he was actually teaching the whole body of teachings gradually. And so while those listening thought that they were on this path that was just sort of based in the Four Noble Truths and dependent arising and so on, and that when they experienced their own enlightenment that was it, he knew all along that's the Phantom City, right? That was his expedient means, and that at that point they are now ready to hear the more complete teaching, which is the Bodhisattva path, the Mahayana path. And those that left in the very beginning weren't wanting that, weren't ready for that, right? So they had not yet developed to the point. I mean, he says that they were arrogant. But another way of thinking of that is they just weren't developed to the point where they sort of had gone past that and were ready to hear this teaching. Okay, so the one vehicle is basically Buddha Dharma, as we understand it, in terms of the Mahayana path of the Bodhisattva.
Just feeling so much like, you know how sometimes we'll be like, well, is Buddhism a religion or is it a philosophy? Is that a religion or is it a philosophy? This feels like such a religious text. And the qualities, you know, all of that like very cosmic language and the qualities of like devotion and sort of like mind expanding possibilities. And it is so like not this mundane world. Mm-hmm. Like all of that kind of atmosphere feels so religious. And then it's so like kind of inspiring to me that like, you know, the teaching, the like revelatory teaching, the like good news, if you will, is like, oh, this teaching of enlightenment of self and other. I don't know. I feel like there's such a, for some reason the word religious keeps feeling so evocative to me in terms of like big and that aspect of our humanity that's mm-hmm. like so like, mm-hmm. like, not of this like mundane, you know, of another dimension. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're not exclusively of this mundane.
I mean, obviously it's completely of this mundane and it's not just what you see.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. For those of you who, you know, Sean is echoing a question that used to come up all the time in the early years, which was, is Buddhism a religion or is it a philosophy or is it just, you know, a practice, like a method? And for a lot of people, that was a very serious question. Because, and I would say, what do you want it to be? Right? If you'd like it to be a religion, it is. Oh my God, is it ever? And if you don't want to be, are you kidding? Of course not. I mean, basically, it doesn't care. Right? Buddha Dharma isn't sort of self-identifying in that way. We do that. And so think in terms of expedient means. If that resonates with you, you know, thinking of this as a religious teaching, thinking of yourself as on a religious path, you are living a religious life as a monastic. And you find that that really, you know, resonates and nourishes and supports and motivates, then you use that, right? And if that gets in the way, thinking of it that way, it's just language, right? So don't think of it that way. But think of it accurately. You know, when you think of it accurately. Think of it as Dharma, as Buddha Dharma. But you don't have to worry about that. That doesn't come up so much anymore. But I was also thinking as you were talking that, and I don't know, but I wonder or perhaps suspect that mystic paths probably almost always have that because that's its nature, is to be a path that is not just accepting or just dealing with the world on the basis of what we can weigh and measure. By its definition, it has faith in and is finding pathways into what we might call a larger dimension or a larger way of seeing things, right? A supramundane or a more inclusive way. And so in that sense, if religious is that, and we might think of religious as being one thing and religion as being another, and happily when they really work together, they don't always, then that could be a way of relating to that, you know? But I think that any path that doesn't just keep you seated in your senses and what you already know, is in some level, on some level, a mystic path. And then how do we, you know, as we see into larger realms, right, how do we speak of that, right? And particularly given our penchant for prose and poetry and imagery and, you know, how to convey and how to inspire, and then how that evolves over time, you know.
I just feel when I read this sutra, and at the very beginning, it's repeating how those, you know, saw the light and, you know, gathering from all directions. And finally, saw these Buddhas, you know, have this light. And I read that Shakyamuni Buddha's, the past life was one of the son of that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I was so moved. I just so moved and just, you know, it's just beyond that, beyond my patience, my whole being to encounter the whole teachings. And so it said that the joy to encounter the Dharma, and now I want to say thank you for letting us read this sutra, because that joy for me to encounter this teaching, you know, I thought that the Four Noble Truths was created, said the first time by Shakyamuni Buddha, but no, it was millions that before him. So that the rare teaching and the rare encounters for us, for me, to meet this teaching, that joy for me is rare, right? So I thank you for this, you know. And really, it's opened, at least, it's opened my mind. It says that, you know, it's not to see this world with your conceptual, what, you know, the whole being. And yes, this is just beginning. Mm-hmm. So I have the faith, mm-hmm. and, you know, I have the faith that, you know, that my that kind of feeling in me that, when I encounter this, I really, wow, yes, thank you, and thank you, yes, and okay, just thank you.
You know, it made me think, when you were talking, it made me think of these writings by these scientists who are talking about, you know, the community of trees and the what's happening underground, under the soil. And I was just reading a book where the biologist was talking about it, and really it's like his brain was breaking, right, as he was trying to think about how is this possible, right? These worlds within worlds and these networks that are just sort of infinite, and that, like, he can't hold it, you know, and it's just blowing his mind, and it's like those worlds are here, right? And so it's also interesting to think about these ancients who were able to devote so much time and energy and over generations, you know, I mean, think about how this has come down to us, these universities, these, you know, governments that were, you know, subsidizing, you know, these projects, you know, to basically develop a lot of these teachings and understandings, and didn't have access to the science that we have, but had understanding, you know, of their natural world, and were seen into, in a mystic sense or in a, you know, in a spiritual sense, these worlds that seem to be here, you know, and have been here all along. And so in that way, is it so fantastical, you know? Yeah. Did you want to, are there some? From online, I'm asking.
Yeah, there's a great deal of venerating the Buddha in the sutra. And there's not much emphasis on this today. Why is this?
Well, it's just, I mean, it's there, but it's just in, you know, it's emphasized in different traditions in different ways. So in Tibetan Buddhism, it's very heavily emphasized. In Zen, I mean, you know, we prostrate to each other, prostrate to each other. Some of us prostrate our prostates. Sekou saying, don't even go there. Just trying to keep it clear. In our tradition, in our Sangha, typically in the Zen tradition, there would be more. And, you know, Daido scaled that down a lot. And so the high seat that the abbot uses during talks, which is a small pine platform, would be a much more elaborate throne. I mean, it's basically a throne that in the Buddha's time, there was a sense of there's the worldly lord or the worldly ruler, and there's the spiritual ruler. And so there's this parallel. I mean, some Rinpoches will actually be carried in their thrones, you know, over land. And so, you know, our version of that is very scaled down. You could think of Nenju, you know, Jahai, you know, these different times where we sort of together or ceremoniously or ritually pay respect, you know, to the teachers or to the abbot who is holding a position, right? And so it's not so much the person as it is, it's like bowing to the Dharma is the way I see it and think of it. And that the person, whoever that person happens to be, or those people, are, you know, standing in the place of, you know, the holders of the Dharma so that we can continue this. And that's a rotating position. It changes, right? As people come and go, as people die and step in. And so it's there, but it's fairly simple in our tradition.
There's another one from Pablo. What are your reasons to believe that there are many lives and many worlds? What to do when it's hard to believe this?
To
believe this, when it's hard to believe this.
Hold it lightly. I'm not asking anyone to believe in it, you know, just because you should. If you think of the difference between belief and faith, you know, there's a relationship. But I think of belief as sort of, well, to think of it this way is of taking on an idea, right? When there's faith in that, then it's different because it's more in you, right? It's not just a thought or an idea, but it's something that is felt, is experienced, as that there's some confidence in. And so, you know, particularly some of the teachings that are not likely to be verified by us in this lifetime, you know, to think of them as expedient means. And so, are they helpful to you? And that's a little tricky, because as Buddhists, you know, Daido Roshi used to talk about cocktail Zen. Cocktail Dharma. You know, when you're at a cocktail party and they bring by a tray of hors d'oeuvres, you say, like, I don't want any of that, but two of those, please. you know, that we pick and choose what we want. And that we may leave something on the plate that's actually extremely important and we don't know it. Or we find it difficult, and so we just think, I can't be bothered. And so that notion of, you know, picking and choosing, in a sense, is inevitable to some degree, because we will likely not engage something very deeply if we don't have some faith in it. But can we be open to things that we might not yet have a lot of faith in and just keep the door open? In other words, don't ignore them. And maybe even periodically make a point of coming back to them and just looking at them again, or seeing what other teachers say about them, or how do those things show up in other teachings, you know? And in other words, sort of be allow yourself to be influenced by how that aspect, whatever it might be, shows up in Buddha Dharma, in the teachings, and just sort of let that in a little bit and see where that goes. So that's my encouragement, you know, that you don't have to feel like you're beholden to have a firm belief or to have a firm disbelief. You know, I mean, if you have deep faith in it, then it's not a question. If you really have trouble with it, just let it be an open thing. I mean, it's just a good practice, as a practice, to keep our minds open and not create sort of dogmas in our mind. Just for its own sake, it's a good practice. So,
take one more. Okay, this is a question about practice. Sometimes I get to a point where things that used to be hard in practice now seem easy. When we arrive at phantom cities in our practice where it seems like we can stop and rest, does that mean it's okay to rest there, knowing that when it's time to move on, the resting place will disappear on its own?
Ryan.
Well, think about it. Take the question back into yourself. What will determine for you whether that is the end of your journey or not? Because you will decide. And so what will influence that decision? Anyone?
Suffering.
You mean if you're still experiencing suffering? Yeah. So if you feel like you've arrived at that phantom city, but you're still seeing the ongoing matter that you originally came in to resolve, and it's not resolved. Anybody else?
Sympathetic joy.
Say more. How's that?
Well, motivator. If you're working your way through the immeasurables, if you're sympathetic joy.
Yeah, but how is that helping you to?
Well, you're not as self-concerned, for one thing.
You're what?
You're not as self-concerned, mm-hmm. and so you have more generosity naturally flowing.
So even if I'm feeling pretty good, I see that there are many others who do not, and that motivates me. Yeah. Can you get, Rob has had his hand up for long.
Well, this is just the answer to that, or in relationship to that, I guess, how deeply you're committed to the faith you have and the precepts and your vows, mm-hmm. and to realizing that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think of bodhicitta, you know, that Keizan says, go back to your original intention, which may be sufficient, or maybe that your original intention needs to be strengthened or informed by what you have discovered. It's like sometimes when people worry that they're, you know, going to get caught up in, you know, some particular, you know, complacency. And I say, well, is that what you want? And they say, no, I don't want that. And I said, that's going to keep you alert. The fact that you don't want that, you know, if you're seeking the first phantom city that comes along, then that's what you're seeking. right? Then when you have found it, that's good news, right? You've basically succeeded. If that is not what you're actually seeking, then you will know that. You may not know it right away, so you might hang out for a while, right? And then at some point, if that is still there within you, it will speak to you, I think, you know, because that's there. But I wouldn't be passive. I wouldn't just assume that, you know, you'll sort of, it'll become obvious and that the phantom city, which is just a metaphor, remember, will drop away. Now, one way that could happen is that whatever we are sort of taking comfort in, you know, my understanding or my experience, that's going to go away, right? That's going to dissolve, because in a way you've put yourself in a God realm for the moment. And remember, the God realm is pretty good, but because we're in the God realm, we don't think about, we don't keep going. And so whatever efforts we made to bring us to that eventually dissolve, and you end up back in a state that is not so happy, right? So, but that's also the function of training. I remember asking Dada Roshi about that many years ago, you know, why, if we are gaining confidence and sort of our lives are, you know, improving and we're gaining confidence in our understanding and so on, why doesn't everybody basically bail out early, you know? And he said, well, that's part of the job of the teacher and it's part of the job of the training, is to keep helping the student to see that there's more and to know that. Okay, why don't we take, we went a little over now, why don't we take just a short break, like 5 short minutes, and then we'll come back. Just take a stretch and then we'll come back. So at 5 minutes, all right. So, going into the next chapter, this is the prophecies conferred on learners and adepts. And this, again, is referring to the Buddha's disciples. And so now he confers a prophecy on Ananda, his attendant and cousin. And he actually says that the Buddha and the Ananda both at the same time conceive the determination to attain enlightenment. And it says, Ananda constantly delighted in wide knowledge. I constantly put forth diligent effort. Therefore, I have already succeeded in attaining Anuttara Samyak Sambuddhi, while Ananda guards and upholds my law. And so remember, Ananda was both the... Oh, okay. Well, I just gave you a little, yeah, a little preview. Right. So here this, thank you. So here this disciple who is Maitreyaniputra, who the Buddha says and is known within the teachings as being foremost in preaching the Dharma. So he was very well known for his ability to do that. So he makes a prediction that he's going to attain perfect enlightenment. He will be called Law Bright, thus come one, and be worthy of offerings. And I want to turn it here in Watson translation on page 146, where it turns into verse, and read that section because it's kind of interesting. He says, you monks listen carefully the way followed by the children of the Buddhas because they are well learned in expedient means is wonderful beyond conception. They know how most beings delight in a little law, right? In the original or the first teaching, the lesser vehicle, and are fearful of great wisdom of the bodhisattva path. Therefore, the bodhisattvas pose as voice hearers or pratyeka buddhas, employing countless expedient means to convert the different kinds of living beings. They proclaim themselves to be voice hearers and say they're far removed from the Buddha way. That is the Bodhisattva path. And so bring emancipation to immeasurable multitudes, allowing them all to achieve success. Limited in aspiration, lazy and indolent, though the multitudes are, bit by bit they are led to the attainment of Buddhahood. Inwardly, in secret, the children of the Buddha act as bodhisattvas, but outwardly they show themselves as voice hearers, really just as the Buddha has done. They seem to be lessening desires out of hatred for birth and death, but in truth they are purifying the Buddha lands. And so there, the way I understand that is that they seem to be lessening desires. They seem to be teaching in a way that is based in the path of a renunciant, that is based in the path of a revulsion for samsara, to want to extinguish all of our attachments. Whereas in the Mahayana tradition, those very attachments are recognized as being fundamentally liberated in and of themselves, in their self-nature. Nothing needs to be destroyed. There is no old age and death and no end to old age and death. So there needs to be no fear or hatred or love in terms of grasping attachment at birth and death. And though they seem to be doing that, teaching that, advocating that, in truth, they are purifying the Buddha lands. They are creating conducive environments within those students to move forward and be able to enter the Bodhisattva path. Before the multitude, they seem possessed of the three poisons or manifest the signs of heretical views. My disciples in this manner use expedient means to save living beings. If I were to describe all the different ways the many manifestations they display in converting others, the living beings who heard me would be doubtful and perplexed in mind. So what do you think of that? How do you hear that?
Okay, this is me asking. Does this imply that that we don't know who a true teacher is?
We don't know
who a true teacher is necessarily. Is this on? Is this on? I can't tell. Oh, there we go. So, is this implying that we can't know who a true teacher is? We don't know the expedient means.
Or is there another way of looking at that?
Every one?
Exactly.
Has that teaching
who is not
expedient means.
Teaching. Now he says that these bodhisattvas are acting in secret. And so sometimes they are acting in secret to us. Sometimes they are acting in secret to themselves. They don't know that they're bodhisattvas, in the sense that they don't know that they are helping us, right? They may actually be hurting themselves. They may be possessed of the three poisons. But whether we are, what we do, remember the chain of causation and dependent origination, right? One aspect conditions the next, conditions the next, conditions the next. So nothing is fixed. Right? So when you have an experience or something happens, your experience of that is not a fixed thing. It is conditioned by karma. Right? And so there's a strong inclination to respond to it in a particular way. Those are all of our habits. Those are our kleshas and afflictions. That's why we keep doing the same thing. But we are not bound to, because that wheel is fluid. It's an open system. And that's where practice is occurring. That's what we're doing. We're getting in there and we're shifting the energy. We're shifting the flow. We're illuminating what has been dark, so that when things happen again, our actual experience is different. And sometimes it's we are mindful and we are choosing to respond in a different way. We have an impulse to act in the old way. but we're making a different choice. That's a big step forward. But going further, that old impulse does not arise. Going further, what arises is the desire to serve this person, the recognition that they are suffering. Is there something I can do? So to think of seeing all of our relationships, right? And, you know, this is can be kind of a cliche. Everyone is my teacher. You know, every experience, every phenomena is Dharma. Mahayana is actually serious about that. So we can turn it into a cliche, and then it's just a cliche. But to actually practice that, it needs to be more than just a nice idea. We have to actually have a path to do that, right? We have to understand what that actually means and how can I do that, right? And so both are true. In one sense, we don't know because it's coming from all directions. You know, I've told this story about it in the early years. I remember somebody asking a question. You know, a senior or, I don't know, Dai Roshi, somebody said something or did something, and somebody came to me and said, and related to me, and said, did they mean to do that as a teaching? And I said, why? And they said, because if they meant to, then I'll practice it, but if they don't, then I'm just pissed, you know? And I thought, I don't remember what I said, but I thought, that doesn't seem like much of a choice. Like, use it. Like, in that sense, it's not that their intention is irrelevant, but it may not be the most important thing. Certainly not in the sense of being, you know, the determining factor in terms of whether I, you know, bind myself further or try and actually use it to my benefit. So here he's again putting this whole sort of perspective. It's getting larger, right? It's like it's you know, in the beginning it was like there are these two paths, they're different, 5,000 leave. It's like, oh my God, what's going on? You know, there's the higher and there's the lower. And what's happening is all of that is dissolving. And everyone's actually in the game. Yusen, can you hand it to Laura?
Well, what you just said about the higher and lower, I think that's been, I've been noticing that sort of as a thread throughout the sutra. Like, maybe I'm just like missing the forest for the trees, but there's a lot of focus on like the ranking of people and like this very accomplished person and even like the idea of a prophecy. I'm not sure I'm getting it. Like, and sort of like what was mentioned before, like it's a self-determined path in a way. Like, maybe you can help me understand, like the Buddha saying, like, I'm like prophesizing, like this is the next one. Like, mm-hmm. That seems, from my understanding, like different than how this path goes. Like, mm-hmm. You don't need an outside, I don't know. Or is that like a transmission? Is a prophecy like a transmission? Or
right.
Like,
so what about these prophets? Now, in the Buddha, just going with what the sutra is saying, taking it in its place, that the Buddha is not saying, I'm going to give this to you. He's saying, you are going to do this. All I'm telling you is it's going to happen, right? But what is the function of that? Like, again, thinking of this in terms of a teaching. And here, you know, there's one, and then there's another, and then there's another. And guess who's coming down the road? Devadatta. What? This complete troublemaker? Hellraiser? Problem? Person? Right? He gets a prophecy. So what's happening here, right? So, you know, just to sort of let that sit in your mind. But in terms of the ranking, So think about so many cultures throughout history that were very patriarchal and very much based in rank, right? Very hierarchical. And, you know, India, China, Japan, America, you know. And we are in a time where some of us are seeing, not enough, but some of us are seeing that there are deep, deep problems in that. And so there's this sense, which is a kind of a revolutionary sense, that everyone deserves an equal life, right? Or an equal opportunity, right? And moreover, that you could, as a basis for a whole country, formed imperfectly, but the vision is clear, though not yet realized, that we could actually be self-governing. What? Are you kidding? That's radical, right? And so we live in a time that is evolving a profoundly, I don't know, utterly different, but the Buddha was very much recognizing the equality of people, right? He basically accepted anyone from, he wasn't.
Apparently. Hmm? Not women, apparently.
Not originally, and he let them in, but yes, he gave them a second class status. So it's imperfect. But in terms of self-nature and the ability to enlighten, he was pretty unequivocal about that. So the disparity between that, sort of his understanding on a spiritual level, versus perhaps we might say what he was able to do on a social level, was not the same. They were not actually, from our perspective, were not in alignment, right? And we see that is an ongoing problem, right? Even within ourselves. But that's just one way of looking at it when you encounter all of this sort of rank language. And so, you know, my encouragement, because there's a lot of, we were talking about this at the monks meeting study yesterday, that, you know, we're relying on translations unless we read the original text. And so we're going to encounter language on an ongoing basis that you may not always know what to do with, right? So try, my encouragement is try and understand the spirit of what's being said, you know, and so the importance of what that's about is being communicated. And don't get too hung up in, that in the displeasure or the distaste of certain words. I mean, I see it too, you know, and so I transform some of the language as I'm going. And some things I just don't even mention. Like there's a sentence in here that I was not going to read, right? Because I think we don't need to carry this forward, right? This doesn't belong in the sutra, but, you know, there it is.
Okay. This is from Sagan. Chapter 8, especially toward the end, seems like a promise of celestial reward. It makes me feel like a kid in the burning house being told all the goodies are outside, but I don't feel my practice is about finding the goodies. So what's your perspective? How should one receive this teaching?
The goodie is the vehicle. It's not you're going to be rich and famous. The goodie is the Mahayana path. That's the ox chariot, right? That's the end of the path once you get past the Phantom City. It's not material wealth, it's not worldly fame, it's that you are able to free yourself of self-clinging and become available to other people as a compassionate being. Those are the treasures. It's the treasure of encountering, of realizing, discovering our Buddha nature. And thus the jewel, right? The Mani jewel. And so, yes, it is interesting that there are so many sort of worldly, object things that are used as incentives. because we can relate to those, right? But it's a different point, I think. There is, because I'm just watching the time, there is this parable at the end of this chapter of the two friends who are getting together, and one of them gets drunk and falls asleep. They've had such a good time, and the other one has to go. But they want to make sure that their friend is taken care of, so they sew this precious jewel into their pocket. The drunk person wakes up, they go off, they struggle as they journey through all kinds of countries. They finally meet up, relays their tale of woe, and the friend says, "Goodness gracious, didn't you know that I had put this jewel in your pocket? You had it all along. You had no need to struggle." And so there's a, he says, "You did not know about it and fretted and wore yourself out trying to provide a living for yourself. What nonsense. You must take the jewel and exchange it for goods." And then the Buddha says, "The Buddha is like this friend. When still a bodhisattva, he taught and converted us, inspiring us in the determination to seek comprehensive wisdom. But in time, we forgot all that, became unaware and unknowing, and attained the way of the arhat. We supposed we had gained extinction." And so on and so forth. And so that's a very straightforward parable. Would that it were so easy. Just pluck it out of your pocket. Okay. Getsudo had sent me a question earlier, and I'll just read it, summarized. He said, "Are these prophecies, upaya to encourage mature practitioners to continue on the path to attain enlightenment, that we at this point that those people only need the assurance that their efforts will be fruitful?" You know, I mean, it's a way of looking at it. It sounds a little like a promise, and the Buddha is offering promises, right? I don't. But of course, I'm not the Buddha. So,
I had a question about that jewel and just the faith that, you know, it takes to believe that jewel is present mm-hmm. in everybody mm-hmm. and including ourselves. Mm-hmm. And you know, how you practice that, mm-hmm. you know, because like you said, would that it were so easy
yeah.
that we always have access to this.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, drinking from the well of these teachings over and over again, hearing it over and over again, hearing it in all of the different voices, from all of the different times, from all the different teachers, different traditions, going all the way back. You know, when we, to have faith in it, you know, is really important. And I think it's really important in particular for people who are, you know, who struggle with self worth, with self-confidence, with, you know, who struggle with self-criticism and, you know, feeling inadequate, that really sort of working with developing faith in Buddha nature is really good medicine. It's, you know, when we realize it, then we see that it has nothing to do with the character of the person. That's where we get hung up. You know, we see somebody who's just like acting like a demon in the world. It's like, how could this person have Buddha nature? And so we really have to understand it has nothing to do with character. It has nothing to do with appearance. It has nothing to do with qualities. It has nothing to do with anything we can, any action or, you know, characteristic of a being. It's just their nature, right? I mean, if you use the analogy of the water, you know, water can kill you, right? It can be a monster, right? It can also, it is life. And so it's, how does it appear? And so I think, you know, that's where it becomes much, much easier to bring forth compassion based on our understanding of Buddha nature, when we really understand that whatever we're seeing is their wheel of conditioned arising, right? Beginning with delusion, mental formations, it's the cycle. We're seeing that cycle play itself out.
Even earlier, you were saying that he was pointing to people who appeared to be caught in desires and so forth, who were actually cultivating a Buddha land. Or, yeah,
right. From the sutra.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, let's say Vladimir Putin is caught in his wheel of karma, right? And yet, according to the sutra, he's also purifying a Buddha land, or no?
Well, the way I was talking about it in a sort of taking it a little bit, sort of expanding on it. But I think what the Buddha is saying is that there are beings who are bodhisattvas, and sometimes they act in a way that seems contrary. Because that, I mean, think in terms of Kenon, rather than that, Kenon takes the form of compassion that will be skillful for the person. And so Daido used to use the, you know, that, you know, if he went in robes to the bar in Phoenicia, you know, that's not going to be, but if he goes in as a truck driver or as a motorcycle rider or as just a dude, you know, or whatever, then he can sit down next to somebody and have a conversation. You know, that's the way I hear him talking about this.
So what you're saying is that in a sense you have to have intention, you know, to yeah. act skillfully and be a bodhisattva, that you know, being a bodhisattva in some ways is not separate from Buddha nature, but it does have to be something that's intended and realized.
Yeah, very much. And that's why, you know, I mean, going back to your question about how do we cultivate this? So think about it, in every liturgy, in every dedication throughout the day, you know, here, the liturgy is constantly bringing this up. We chant the four vows, we, you know, the evening gatha, verse of the kesa, it's always being, it's just a drumbeat. It's always there, right? And our task, our work, is to keep hearing it. Is to keep hearing it and hear it, right? And take it in, that when you're chanting the four vows, you are chanting those vows, right? When we're chanting the verse of kesa, you know, this vast robe of liberation, formless field of benefaction, I wear the Tathagata's teachings, saving all sentient beings. You know, that when we do the four immeasurables in the morning, you're doing that from the depths of your heart, right? Because the more it's coming from deep within, the more it is changing us. It's guiding us, right? It's becoming us, right? Okay, so shall we finish up? And so we'll come back in 2 weeks with the next few chapters, okay? Sekko will remind us why we're here.